From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. On John Rainier's 21st birthday, he received a letter saying he was selected to go into the U.S. Army. He ended up overseas in 1944 as an assigned medic. During his service, Rainier witnessed and experienced some of the more historic moments during World War II, including the liberation of a slave labor camp. Rainier now lives in Stevens Point with his wife. The 90-year-old makes it a point to share his stories. This week, he's participating in Viterbo University's Holocaust Educators Workshop, which wraps up tomorrow. Also presenting at the workshop is Aquinas High School junior Sean Van Domelen, who has made a documentary about Rainier's experiences during World War II. I talked with Rainier and Van Domelen earlier today about the importance of preserving veterans' stories. Rainier starts out by sharing his own.
Normandy had been invaded, and the war went on there for several weeks, and finally we got to Normandy right after it had been liberated. And it was total devastation, but we joined. The war moved rapidly then to northern France, and we were temporarily assigned to be extra help in a MASH-type field hospital just behind the front lines in northern France. The Third Army finally broke through the old Maginot Line fort area and took over the remainder of northern France before the invasion of Germany. We were scheduled to be a part of the invasion of Germany force from northern France when the Germans broke out their last big offensive in Belgium, the Battle of the Bulge.
And you were present, and you were working medic
our,
there.
Our orders were immediately changed from preparing to go into Germany from France, and the Third Army was moved up into Belgium. That became the Battle of the Bulge, and we were assigned to the 4th Armored Division, our regular duty at that time.
Can you talk about what it was like to be a medic during this time? Because all I can imagine is no downtime and almost pure chaos.
Well, at the hospital, where we worked 12-hour shifts 7 days a week. 1 week we worked from 6 in the morning to 6 at night. The next week, 6 at night to 6 in the morning. During the heavy fighting that was going on for many weeks in the fall of 1944, they were doing from 100 to 150 surgeries every 24 hours in that hospital. There was two big ward tents with 8 operating tables going 24 hours a day.
And were you performing surgeries?
No, I didn't perform any surgery, but I was assigned to work in the surgery unit. There was a third tent attached to the two surgeon tents for the dressing and sterilization. They prepared all the surgical packs, and the Army nurses ran that, and I worked in that unit. It went back and forth to the surgery tent quite regularly, bringing stuff in and taking out, and I saw the tremendous number of terrible American casualties coming through at that time, and there was everything from major brain surgery, spinal surgery, a lot of amputations, and some simple bullet wounds where they get a few stitches and back to duty.
And were you only working with American soldiers?
Yes, just American soldiers. Until the Third Army finally took over the old Maginot Line fort area in northern France, there was a large number of German casualties in the bunkers there that had no medical care. So they immediately became prisoners of the United States, our Army. And I happened to be working nights when the first convoy of ambulances came in with German wounded. And that was quite a new experience because that's when I first learned about the term SS troops. I had never heard it before.
And what is an SS officer?
That was the fanatical elite part of the German military. But there was a young 22-year-old SS officer that had had an arm blown off at the shoulder. He had had practically no medical attention. He had badly infected, but he was still close to death, but still conscious. And he was brought in and put on a table, and I happened to be in the surgery section when he was brought in, and the surgeon and his technician came in and looked at the vital signs sheet that had been made in the ambulance coming down, and the surgeon said, if we have any chance of saving this guy, he's going to need whole blood and need it fast. Whole blood was used very sparingly because it was always in short supply. It was used primarily for the near-death cases. And this young man had feebly raised his left arm. And he said, what kind of blood is it going to be? And the surgeon said, oh, what's the problem? It'll be the right type of blood. He said, well, if it's Jew or Negro blood, I don't want it. So this is the first exposure I had to hearing the fanaticism of those, the way they were trained, totally religious and racial prejudice, yeah. Pure Aryans. Mm-hmm. The surgeon pulled the sheet over him and he said, take this man off the table. There's men waiting that want to live more than he does. So they took him out of surgery, and I never did know what happened, but I'm sure he died that night. Hmm.
And you were present at another important moment in World War II history. You were there as a concentration camp in Austria was liberated. Oh, yes. Can you please tell us about that?
I got into Germany after the Battle of the Bulge. That was a very different experience coming through France, Belgium, and Luxembourg. We were the liberators, the American Army. And of course, the civilians were just welcomed us with the heave a sigh of relief because they had been under the Nazi system for many years. So we got into Germany, and of course the climate was very different because we were the conquerors then. So the civilians were very suspicious of us and very guarded, and there was an awful lot of damage and unfolding as the war progressed, and there was heavy fighting before we crossed the Rhine River. Once we crossed the Rhine River, the war went rather rapidly the rest of the way because the Germans, the regular German military, realized that the war was, they were very well beaten. The biggest, the bulk of the casualties that were happening after we crossed the Rhine were pockets of SS troops that would get behind our lines and cause some havoc, and especially with the convoys driving at night. Our unit was still supporting the 4th Armored Division, and the war was moving rather rapidly, so they were 2-3 days ahead of us most of the time because we had very few casualties to deal with. But we came through this little town of Ohrdruf, Germany, we had never heard of course, but it was a typical small German community, and our convoy came through the town, and our commanding officer in the lead jeep took note of a collection of American Army people in a field adjacent to the highway. So pulled off to see what this was and learned that General Eisenhower, Patton, and Bradley had just arrived to go through the first slave labor camp the American armies had liberated.
Wow.
We hadn't even heard about slave labor camps up to that time. So our convoy pulled off and joined a group of, probably 150 to 200 GIs and went through this camp with the high command. This was quite an unusual and very unique experience. But that was a tremendously shocking thing because the SS troops guarded and ran the slave labor camps in Germany.
And I can imagine if you had not even realized that these slave labor camps existed,
no.
And then to walk through those gates.
And before the 4th Armored Division got to that camp, we learned later Hitler through Himmler, the head of the SS troops that in the slave labor camp operation, had given orders that as the American armies were approaching, they were to eliminate the evidence in the camps as much as they could, and if they couldn't get it all eliminated, to move slave labor, either kill them in the camp before they left, all those that they didn't want to move, but any that were healthy enough to work, they'd move them ahead of the war to the next camp. And Ordrift was a few miles west of Buchenwald, which was one of the major camps. So there were quite a few of the healthier prisoners that were moved to Buchenwald before the Americans came. And then they machine gunned about 3,500 of those that were in real bad shape, and then the SS moved on. So there was when the Fourth Army took over, they took over largely dead camp, you know. But then they moved on right away to liberate Buchenwald. And so the Eisenhower and Patton and Bradley came to go through this first big camp, and their grounds are still littered with bodies, and this was a tremendously shocking and different experience than any of us had ever imagined.
You know, I can't even imagine.
Because dealing with the carnage of battle, where it's kill or be killed, as we had at the hospital, terrible as it was to see wounded GIs, you'd know that they had been unlucky enough to get hit before they could kill the other guy. But here, these poor people were just totally at the mercy of these brutal guards, and many of them were just skin and bones. Of course, this we heard the comments that Eisenhower and Patton made when they opened up the door of the body shed at the crematorium with stacks of corpses. And then after going through the camp, we heard Eisenhower give Bradley and Patton orders about rounding up civilians near these camps as work gangs to dig up the mass graves and build cemeteries as a lasting monument to Nazism, was the directive he gave them. And that became the model.
And you're listening to Newsmakers. My guest today is John Rainier. He's a World War II medic, and he is joined with Sean Van Domelen, who is a junior at Aquinas High School and has made a film about Mr. Rainier. They are both speakers at Viterbo University's Holocaust Educators Workshop. So, Sean, Mr. Rainier has an incredible story and has witnessed things that not many people in this world have. Was that your main reason that you decided you wanted to make a short documentary about him, or why else was it that you wanted to highlight his life?
I thought his story really needed to be told. My interest in World War II really came from my grandfather, and he passed away before I really could get to know him and could really ask him much about his role in World War II. So it was really a learning experience, and I just wanted John's story to be told.
Why do you think it's important for someone like you? I mean, you talked about your grandfather and how you wished you could have talked with him more. But why do you think it's important for younger generations to remember stories like Mr. Rainier's?
Well, really forgetting what happened, almost kills them again. It's important because a lot of people don't know what happened, and people don't read history, and it ends up repeating itself.
And John Rainier, I'm wondering if you can talk about the importance of sharing veteran stories. There's the Veterans History Project, which is a national project, and the Library of Congress has been collecting stories from veterans. But why is it important for you to share your story and for others to as well?
Well, I think learning the history of warfare is of extreme importance. Wars is a cruel, very inhuman way to attempt to solve problems, either between nations or whatever. Of course, we no longer, the wars that we've had in Iraq and Afghanistan, I don't believe are properly nomenclatured as wars. They're more terrorists fight police work where there's no nation wars as history has always had, or you knew what the enemy, who the enemy was and where they were, and it was a war is a cruel, inhuman way to attempt to solve problems. But I think that there's never been a good war, as some people like to describe, but I think the two most necessary historical wars we've had were the Civil War and World War II, because if we hadn't gone into World War II when we did, England was the last Western European country to be taken by Germany, and they would have had a good chance to get England if we hadn't gone into the war when we did. If the Germany had gotten England, they would have had all of Western Europe, and God knows what the world would be after that. But I think that it's wonderful that young people like Sean have an interest in history, because I think it's too easy to get sold a bill of goods by politicians who have never experienced war, that sometimes they're making decisions for countries that aren't really in the interest of the world.
And Sean, do you follow maybe the current wars or missions going on, or do you find many of your friends and classmates are paying attention to what's going on?
I try my best to pay attention to what's going on in the news, but a lot of my friends, unfortunately, don't have a strong interest in history, so it's kind of hard for me to relate and share that. But
and why do you think it's important to follow the news?
Just to really keep up on what's happening, and just because it's not something that's a part of your life doesn't mean it's worthless, that you shouldn't know about it.
And can you talk about maybe the first time you heard John Rainier's story, what it meant to you and why you decided to reach out to him?
Well, I was introduced to John through Daryl Clodd, who's another Holocaust educator.
And at Viterbo University.
At Viterbo, yep. And we went over to his house and we did, you know, kind of a preliminary interview. And, you know, the story was really inspiring. And there's a lot of things in there that really shouldn't be forgotten.
And John, I'm sure you've shared this story many times throughout your life. What has sharing it done for you? And also, how have those events affected you throughout your life?
Well, I have gotten involved in this primarily after I retired. It seems that for many years, of course, after World War II, I went to college and got married and started a career.
And what was that? What was your career?
I had a career with Century Insurance primarily, yes. I started with them in Minneapolis and then transferred to Stevens Point, the home base. But I spent 32 years with Century and was primarily in human resource management after going through learning something about the insurance business and a few jobs before that. Been retired for about 26 years now.
So. Enjoying your time, I'm sure.
Yes, very much. And the interest in World War II really escalated in our society after the 50th anniversary of D-Day, when many books were written, Studs Terkel, Stephen Ambrose, Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation. And this kindled tremendous interest in World War II, and even among we veterans hadn't, of course, all these years building a career and raising a family and so forth. There wasn't much talk about reminiscing about the wars. Well, I got started on this. I was invited by one of the history teachers at our university in Stevens Point to talk to his class. And I had my little 35 millimeter pictures from the pictures we took at Ardorf that I spoke from and told my story to his history class. And he volunteered to take my little pictures to the media lab and have them put on slides. So I had a slideshow developed of my story. And so then I got involved with teaching, having sessions at the high school and college classes, and And it seemed to really rekindled a lot of interest, and that's what started being this. I felt developed really a feeling of a bit of obligation to share my story if there's tremendous interest among a lot of young people like Sean, which we really need, I think, to have the potential to the next generation grows up to make better decisions than some of the old ones.
And Sean, did you use some of John's photos that he had? Because in your movie, you use photos, archival video, which I'm wondering if you could talk about the process of going through all that and putting your movie together.
Well, I didn't really know how to put a documentary together on like a Mac with a movie program.
With iMovie?
With iMovie, mm-hmm. Yes. So I had to contact Heather Holm, who's a student here at UWL, and she helped me put it together. But we did end up using a few of John's photos, but for some reason the scanning of the 35 millimeters didn't go very well, so a lot of them didn't have a great quality. In terms of archival footage, we found this website called Critical Past, and you could purchase either photos or videos, and I ended up using one of them in my presentation.
What was that like going through the archival footage? Because I mean, some of the footage you have is pretty incredible.
Yeah, it's a very powerful video, and they do have a lot on the website. So there was a fair amount to choose from. But I really thought the video of Hitler inspecting the Hitler Youth at a rally was one I really wanted to use.
This is not the first movie you've made. Can you talk about your previous movies and maybe your plans for the future?
Well, this is the first documentary I've made. The first one was another interview. I took an online class through Northwestern for history, and my teacher there ended up taking the video of me and the World War II veteran in the same shot and then being interviewed, and then he put that on YouTube. But this was the first documentary, and I don't really know how I'm going to use it yet. I might look into contacting the World War II Museum in New Orleans or the Holocaust Museum, and I definitely want to keep interviewing World War II veterans in the future.
Sean Van Dommelen is a junior at Aquinas High School who recently made a documentary about John Rainier. Rainier is a Stevens Point resident and was a medic during World War II. Both are presenters at Viterbo University's Holocaust Educators Workshop, which is taking place until tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. Our production team includes Steve Roysom, John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. In addition to Newsmakers, you'll find archived reports and special series produced by the La Crosse News Bureau. And if you'd like to comment on this week's Newsmakers or have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/lacrosse. Newsmakers is also now on Facebook. Updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Follow us at WPR Newsmakers on Facebook.